Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, a companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois, now playing at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
Well, hello and welcome to the State of Sound podcast. My name is Corinne Claycomb with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. On today's episode, we're talking with Rosanna Goodman, the daughter of the great folk writer, songwriter, all-around cool, friendly guy in the folk music scene, Steve Goodman. So to get us started, I would like to introduce my co-host, Jacob Freefeld. Hello, Jake.
Thanks, Corinne. I'm Jake Freefeld, the Illinois Midwest Studies Research Historian at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library. And yes, today we're talking about Steve Goodman. And I'm excited to do this because as a Cubs fan, he's beloved to me and Cubs fans out there. But he didn't get us started singing about the Chicago Cubs. He got started as a young man. He was born in 48. So in the 60s, he's part of this, or he gets attracted by this 1960s folk revival. So we're talking people like Bob Dylan, Simon and Garfunkel, and this really gets him into music. And then he finds success early in the 1970s in the Chicago club. So this community of musicians, he's opening for Chris Christopherson, and who introduces him them to Paul Anka, who puts up money for his first demo, which then leads to his first album, self-titled Steve Goodman. Probably his most famous song, City of New Orleans, comes out of that album and is covered by many other people for the rest of his career, and that really gets his music career going.
Yeah, basically in just a little over a decade, he releases something like 11 albums, both live and studio productions, and it was that 1971 self-titled album that had City of New Orleans on it, and one of his biggest hits, as you said, covered by so many people, Arlo Guthrie, Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson. It was actually the Willie Nelson version of the song that won Goodman his first of two posthumous Grammy Awards. Other significant hints included You Never Even Called Me By My Name, which was performed with a close friend and colleague, John Prine, who they had a very special close relationship with that we'll hear a lot more about in the interview. And Daly's Gone, which was actually written about former Chicago Mayor Richard Daly. And Goodman is really just a Chicago feature. And he, as we just mentioned, you can't say the Cubs without thinking of Steve Goodman. He wrote Dying Cubs fans' Last Wish, Last Request.
Request.
And When the Cubs Go Marching In. And, of course, Go Cubs Go, which is now played following every Cubs home win. We heard a lot of that back in 2016. We were all very excited. He was actually supposed to do the national anthem, I believe, before the game, just a week or so after he passed. They had scheduled him to go to sing. But as I mentioned, he won one posthumous Grammy for the Willie Nelson version of City of New Orleans, and then eventually he had a record called Unfinished Business released in 1988 that won him his second posthumous Grammy, and that was 4 years after his passing at the age of 36 after over a decades-long battle with leukemia. But in covering Goodman's life, a lot of the writers and researchers just note his optimism and his spirit and good humor that he maintained, and a lot of what we hear from Rosanna in the interview is this really tight-knit group of songwriters and how it was just a really fun and optimistic time and place to be in music history. So we're going to hear a lot more about that from Rosanna. We'll go ahead and throw it straight to the interview. Here we have Rosanna Goodman speaking with Dave Hoekstra.
Welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I'm Dave Hoekstra, and we're on the phone with Rosanna Goodman, the youngest daughter of the legendary singer-songwriter Steve Goodman, and she's also doing independent video production. Are you out in California, Rosanna?
I am. I'm living out in L.A. Hello, everyone.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. So much to talk about. A lot of people will be listening to this, so why don't we just talk about your dad a little bit, and for people who may not know much about him. I mean, we do have the City of New Orleans stuff in the exhibit. So talk about your dad.
Well, Steve Goodman, the performer and songwriter and father, and inspiration to a lot of other singer-songwriters at the time in the 70s. There was a time in the Chicago music scene where it was a community of musicians. They sang each other's songs. They recorded them. They played together, they headlined for each other, and those types of relationships and music seem to have gotten lost, you know, somewhere, and there's a new resurgence of it back, but I think Steve Goodman and John Prine and the others from this era were really the champions of that songwriter musicianship and friendship that was long-lasting.
Yeah, you talk about community. We've been talking about that in some of the other interviews we've done. I mean, what have you learned? What did you learn about that? And you were just, according to my numbers, you were just 7 years old when your dad passed away, right, in 1984?
Yeah, I was seven, so I still have the imagination. I wasn't quite sure, you know, it was true. But recently we had to dig up the death certificate for something, and I was like, oh, it is true. It did happen. But it's a child's imagination, you know. But, the thing about loss and the death, especially with somebody who is in the public eye but was also really honored and revered by his colleagues, that spirit of friendship seemed to never go away. I mean, it extended to me and my family. We remained very close with Al Bonetta and John Prine and other musicians that worked with my dad. And, you know, I grew up with stories of how great and talented and amazing my dad was, and the impact that he had on people's lives in general, and how very generous he was. And to think of that legacy, there's nothing I love more than to honor it by letting people know who may not have ever heard of him, what his contribution to the world was, and really try to keep the music moving, keep it going forward. You know, it's a legacy that I carry a torch for. And I'm sort of now making it a mission to really sort of reunite the world to my dad's music.
Good for you. Did it take a time for you to get in that place? How did that evolve?
Yeah, you know, it absolutely did. You know, when I was growing up, you know, I liked my dad's, you know, I was just a kid, so I liked my dad's silly songs, Elvis imitators and Talk Backwards, and, you know, but there's such a catalog. In 2006, I decided with some friends of mine to put together a tribute album because I wanted a younger group of musicians to reinterpret these songs. And for me, it was me having a relationship with songs that I didn't connect to as a child. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, after the loss of Al Bonetta and most recently John Prine, it's time that, you know, their story and their friendship together and their individual legacies, but the legacy together of what they had was pretty magical. And I would like to honor it for all of the widows, you know, Don Bonetta, my mom, Nancy Tenney, and Fiona Prine.
Sure.
Because they were the hearts and souls behind the men and the music, you know.
I think I might have emailed you. I was playing this the other day. It came out on John's Old Boy Records label. But you covered My Old Man. Talk about you tackling that song that your dad wrote.
I miss my old man tonight.
I really wanted to perform a song on the album. You know, I didn't want to overwhelm it with just me. That I producing it was the experience of me reliving it, and I really loved hearing the other interpretations from musicians. But there was no way I could do this album and not choose that song. you know, it's a family portrait. And I chose not to change the lyrics, you know, even though it's about my grandfather, because it still resonates. I mean, the intent behind the song and the mourning in the lyrics is, you know, unique to its own. And, you know, I've often said most people, like on Father's Day, or people who have lost their fathers, all really relate to that song, in a general sense. And so I wasn't going to miss the opportunity. And recording it was one thing, but it was when I got to play it live, I really connected with it.
Do you sing at other places? Is this something you've pursued, or is this just like a one-off?
That was a one-off. I had a all-girl kind of pop punk band in the early 2000s in New York, and I was the lead singer, and that was a lot of fun. But as somebody who's always worked in the music industry, I've worked for record labels and, you know, production companies and studios. I really liked being behind the scenes, and I really love to sing, but it's something that I enjoy so much that I was not interested in being criticized for it or selling it, really. You know, it's just something that makes me happy. So to keep it pure, I decided to work in the music industry and, you know, sing for fun here and there.
Can you, and I'm looking at the CD, I brought it down here. The first track is Old Fashioned, but you...
My friends are always telling me that I'm old fashioned, out of date and born too late to ever catch on, but...
Can you talk about the meaning of family with your dad? I mean, Old Fashioned, Hand It to You, and then the songs. I mean, you know, Rosanna's Reel, Jesse's Jig, Sarah's Jump. Just about the dynamics of family and how important that was to your father.
I mean, it was incredibly important. When he was diagnosed, you know, at 21 with leukemia and with all of the treatments, they basically said that he couldn't have children. And my mom and he wanted a child so badly that Earl Pianchi actually got them a lawyer. And they adopted my oldest sister, Jessie. And it was just, you know, two years after that Sarah was conceived. So, you know, he got to have all the things that he thought he never could. Uh-huh. And family was one of them. You know, he was on the road a lot, but, you know, if he was home, we would skip school and he would take us to movies or ball games and play with us. On the road, he wrote children's stories on postcards for my mom to read to us at bedtime.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Every night, yeah. They're pretty cool. My favorite was this character, I Don't Know Jones was his name. And It was pretty much the same joke every time. He'd knock on a door and they'd say, what's your name? I don't know. I don't know Jones. But that was always a super delight, and you know, I hope I find them. I know they're in a box somewhere.
Wow. What was it? You mentioned movies. Did I hear or read somewhere that you went to see Superman? Do you remember this? You went to see Superman or something, and you guys liked it so much. You went in. And he says, "Let's go, just see it again." Remember stuff like that?
Yeah, definitely. We would always do things like that. And, you know, we weren't censored children and it was the 80s, but, you know, it was all about spending time together. You know, his major loves were baseball, family, and music. And when he could do them all at the same time, that was great. But when it was time to be with us, he was ever present, you know.
You spent most of your childhood between California and in California and New York, right? Not so much in Chicago?
Yeah. So I guess I was three when we moved from Chicago to Seal Beach, California. Right. And, you know, it was mainly that my dad was sick and recovering and wanted to be in nice weather. But Chicago is the soul of where both my parents come from. And there's nothing like that city. I mean, we always went to visit. We went to visit, you know, my grandmother Manette and great grandma Mary. And, you know, there's a lot of my dad's spirit, and it's in Chicago.
Manette was the best. I hung out with her a couple of times. Did I ever tell you the story?
If you were on her good side.
I'm sure I told you this, but because it sticks in my memory. But we took her to a Jimmy Buffett show, and it was her and Richard Harding from The Quiet Night. Oh, man, it was crazy. But, you know, we went backstage, and Buffett couldn't have been nicer to them. They were just, but yeah. So, you know, Buffett, I mean, we were sitting there, and they gave us really nice seats. We were in the front row, close to the front row, and everybody's doing fins with their arms in the air, and there's Manette. You know how tiny she was.
But
Buffett was always such a champion of your dad's stuff. And I think he dedicated a song to them and stuff. It was a memorable night. But yeah, Manette was my date that night, so it was pretty funny.
Yeah, she's a good date. She's a good date. I think I have a picture from that night of her with her famous finger pointing in Jimmy's chest.
where I was going with where you lived, are you a baseball fan, and did you have to become a Cubs fan, or how, you know?
That is a good question. That is a really good question. So my sisters and I were all very sporty. We were in, you know, little league, soccer, you know, basketball, you name it. So when we moved to New York, I was about 10 years old, and, you know, in New York, there's not a lot of like playground space for football and stuff. So Sarah and I both became basketball athletes in school and loved it. And, you know, that's why my dad said that he married my mom, who was so tall, so that he could have basketball players for their children. So we felt like we were honoring, you know, his wishes there. But I am a Mets fan.
Are you really?
I am, and a Cubs fan.
Okay.
But mostly I'm a National League fan.
Uh-huh.
And that was what I had to. I wasn't allowed to choose an American League team.
Uh-huh.
There's no designated hitting, you know?
Yeah, right.
That's not right.
Yeah.
So that's what I was brought up to believe. So National League teams were okay. And so I went with the Mets.
Okay. All right. It was 69 Mets. You weren't around yet, but they broke our hearts.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, I know they did.
So that leads into, they asked me to ask you about the loans you provided for the museum here. So thank you very, very much. Like Lance said, they're right when you walk in, you get greeted with, I'm looking out the window right now, there's spiritual empowerment with, I'm looking at Mahalia Jackson, then across there's Folk, and there's your dad, and there's Brian. So that's what gets people right when they walk into the exhibit. So talk about the Cubs jacket and, of course, the lyrics. So talk about the stuff you so graciously loaned us.
So I loaned my dad's satin Cubs jacket, which can be seen in lots of pictures, but most notably, I think when he was performing Dying Cubs Fans Last Request in the seats at Wrigley Field.
Mm-hmm.
Those vintage team jackets are so hipster right now. But there's certain items that are more than just sentimental. You know, they represent a whole being. And that jacket is sort of what I say would be like iconically Steve Goodman.
Yeah.
It's tiny. It's like a certain era. And, you know, I got to wear it when Minette threw the first pitch at a Cubs game. And I was there with my sister, Jessie, who was wearing our Goodman number one Cubs jersey that they gave us. And I was wearing Dad's satin Cubs jacket. And it was just, it felt amazing. It felt right. They were playing the Mets, by the way.
Oh, were they?
The Mets lost that day.
You said it has a special memory since you lost both Jesse and Minette not long after that. It's very, I told you that note you wrote me. It's your last joyous memory of us together. That's yeah. Really touching.
Yeah. I mean, there wasn't, with Minette in Chicago, you know, we would try to visit each other all as much as possible. But sometimes it would be one of us or two of us or at different times. And so just being together, especially with those two women, was just a beautiful day.
Yeah. When you came back, I don't know how often you came back to Chicago, but like when was Earl alive? Did you go see him? Did you go see some of these people, or did you have time to do that?
Growing up, we did see Earl pretty often, but you know, once we moved to New York, my mom, she had put herself through nursing school and then was working full time at an emergency room in Harlem and getting her master's at Columbia. So we didn't have a lot of time to necessarily like really keep in touch with the people in our lives. But we loved Earl. We used to go to his house and stay in his pool and, you know, we kept in touch as much as we could. You know, Al was really our sort of champion for keeping certain relationships alive.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, it's a hard thing to do as a mom, a single mom with three kids. So
we should tell listeners who may be tuning in who Earl Pianchi was and the Earl of Old Town. If we could just do a little 101 on who he was.
And, you know, on Earl?
I know we don't have enough time to do the whole thing, but he was a rock on tour. But, yeah, in your own words, talk about Earl. And just you touched about this at the beginning. I mean, it was a sense of community. You know, clubs have that so much anymore, you know, but go ahead.
Yeah, so Earl Pianchi, yeah. He owned the Earl of Old Town. I think it was on Lincoln?
Wells, I believe, yeah.
Yeah,
not far from Second City, right across, yeah.
Right by Second City. It was a amazing live music venue, and Earl really championed songwriters and really brought into the fold a whole amazing scene of musicians that, you know, there were, you know, the typical Chicago blues clubs and things like that. And he really kind of opened it up to folk music and the sounds of the city and with the artists like Bonnie Kolak and the Holsteins and Fred and Ed,
yeah, right.
and my dad and John Prine. And my dad was, they used to have at the Earl of Old Town, Earl would have these huge New Year's Eve parties and people from Second City would come and Bette Midler would perform. And, you know, they would have these big raucous nights. And, Earl was a true friend. You know, he helped my parents, you know, when they needed to get their first apartment and when they needed to adopt Jesse, he offered to pay for it. The lawyer's fees and all of that, you know, he believed in the community that he was building and he was a true friend.
Boy, isn't that something? I mean, you know, yeah, that's great stuff. He was a Sox fan. I remember sometimes, you know, I'm a big baseball fan, but one, I remember one time wandering up the upper deck at the, I don't know what they were calling it then, U.S. Cellular, or, you know, but it was a new ballpark. And there was Earl by himself up in the upper deck, and he brought in his own little, you know, lunch sandwich. He had a beer, but yeah, he was really a character. He was really
David Goodman, my dad's brother, is also a Sox fan.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that. I know David, but I didn't know that. This really touches me. I've been telling people I just like the stuff that really kind of humanizes. The rock and roll, and you can see outfits, and you can see guitars and instruments. But then when you see stuff like the City of New Orleans, a lyrics sheet. So talk about that. It's really touching to see that in person.
Riding on the City of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. There's 15 cars and 15 restless riders.
Yeah, you know, Albedetta had that for a long time. And after, who was my dad's manager and John Fine's manager for many, many years, he had that framed in his house. And after he passed away, my sister, got it. And, you know, we were starting to work with Omnivore Records on the Steve Goodman demos release. And I have boxes and boxes of photos and things and all kinds of stuff. And I was really trying to think of like what I could help offer to the demos, and I was like, well, there's nothing better than the actual lyrics being handwritten and crossed out, and you know, you can see the sort of craft of the songwriting in it. My dad wrote City of New Orleans on his way south to visit my mother's grandmother, and she fell asleep, and he wrote the song on the train. And you know, that song is, you know, his number one, you know, glory of songwriting. I mean, it's been said that it's the best train song ever written by people like Johnny Cash and others that have performed it. And, you know, just to see, for me also, when I go into a museum, if I go into like the Rock and Roll Museum in Cleveland, like, I was all about the costumes, or when I saw the Bowie exhibit, you know, it's like anything that has that personal touch, and you know, it was their hand, their cross out, their mind working around lyrics. And, you know, he used to hold songwriting classes out at, you know, folk festivals and, you know, backstage and workshops. He loved the art of songwriting, and I think it was his absolute number one talent, you know, aside from his musicianship and being able to play, it was really the art of the song, and it was genreless. He loved all genres. So it just made it more fun. And to see the handwritten lyrics, and they're ripped, and there's, you know, for me, it's like seeing the crossed out line, you know, like an afterthought is sort of magical.
It's very nice. So, thank you. Thank you so much for that. You mentioned the Omnivore stuff. What can you talk about that? It's the demos and what's on it, and what's the timetable for that? I don't know much about that.
Yeah, so Omnivore Records is putting out Steve Goodman, the demos. It sure looks good on paper, the Steve Goodman demos, sorry. And it is coming out May 14th. And they're releasing vinyl and CD and digitally. It has, you know, an early band demo of City of New Orleans. And
oh, really?
He never even called me by my name. And for me, the most fun that I've been looking forward to having come out was the Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid demo. My dad was working on the soundtrack with Carl Reiner and Steve Martin. And, you know, that song it's been around and it didn't make it to the soundtrack. But it's a really beautiful song.
What's it called? Is it
Dead Men Don't Wear Black?
It is called that. Wow.
Yeah. And Face on the Cutting Room Floor, which I think the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band did.
Yeah.
But I love my dad's version of it. And I think it's a really cool song. those are all on there. The Ballad of Paul Powell, which was not released, I think on CD before. Some surprises in there, Omnivore. I've been so thankful to have my dad's sort of catalog in their hands to produce. Shara Pilecki, who's one of the presidents of Omnivore, has just been a joy to work with. And she's a fan, and it feels like a good home for my dad's music. They also released all of the Red Pajamas albums, and Artistic Hair, Affordable Art, and Santa Ana Winds from my dad's own indie label that we started at our kitchen table.
Mm-hmm.
And Red Pajamas Records was actually the first indie label to ever get major distribution. Now everybody has their own indie label, but nobody was doing it back then.
And you started at the kitchen table?
Yep. I have pictures and cameras of us all packaging records at the kitchen table. We used to help them wheel them down to the post office. And yeah, it was a mom and pop shop record label.
Wow. Wow. Did you ever network with Prine about what he was doing with Old Boy?
Prine actually started Old Boy after seeing the success my dad was having.
Okay. Yeah.
And so he decided to do it with Al too. And start Old Boy. But yeah. And I have that out of John Prine's mouth in an interview I did with him.
Let me ask you this. I want to go into what you do in video production and I don't know if you write or if you write songs or write poetry or write short, but what I want to get at is, what did you learn from your father in terms of the time, up to you were seven and then all the research you've done and listening to his music? What have you learned about the art of telling a story?
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. In some strange ways, my dad had this insane sort of jukebox memory. He could hear a song once and play it back. And I have a similar musical tick. I know lyrics for, I don't know how many hundreds of songs, just like locked in my brain. And I've just always been a musical person or more of a performer. I enjoy it. And, a lot of people close to my dad, have always said that, I have a similar spirit in how I tell a story. And, even if it's true or not, just that compliment alone helps give me that sort of familial connection, to know that I can just keep going. Telling a story, and making art is a valuable thing in our society and on all of our communities. We need this to tell the stories of others and even to imagine a better future. And when I write, I do write songs, and I did for my band, and poetry here and there, but it's a release is what it is. It's a way to reimagine, something that did happen or feel the spirit. Some of my songs, they were pretty like Brooklyn girl is against the world type of stuff. I think my best song was called, and I don't know if you can say this on your podcast, Punk Bitch.
Yeah.
But uh-huh. I wrote it as I was, it's basically a boxing match where I basically tear down this other girl who thinks she's better than me. Uh-huh. And it was very Brooklyn tough. But it was a release, you know, it's not really who I am, but it was fun to be that character and to like sort of let that part of me out. My dad was also very competitive. So, you know, I have that nature in me too.
That's good stuff. I didn't know this, that there's going to be a screenplay with a working title, Somebody Else's Troubles, written by Robert Morgan Fisher.
Yes, there is a screenplay written by Robert Morgan Fisher. It is really incredible. I don't know how they're going to cast the amount of people they would need to fill in this script. I mean, but I would think actors would jump at the chance, like, to play a young Steve Martin or Jimmy Buffett or John Prine or, you know, any of them. It's going to be Hillary Clinton, who my dad went to high school with. So I think it's going to be really fun. It's a beautiful script. He worked really closely with my sister and I to really make the characters people that we know and love. And I hope it comes across to everybody else that way. He just did an incredible job, and I'm excited and I'm really pushing forward to get it in the right hands.
Is there a timetable for that?
No. I mean, from what I know, it takes years to make a movie.
Yeah, right.
So I'm just going to be sort of relentless. This I get from Manette. So my Manette pushiness will get this movie made in the next couple years, I'm sure.
And we should say it's based on the book that Clay Eales did. That book is something. It's like 9,000 pages.
Yeah, 800 pages.
Yeah.
If you want to know what toothpaste he used before his bar mitzvah, you can look that up on page 7.
Yeah. So go ahead. So is it loosely based on that, or are they? I mean, I talked to Clay. It's a very well researched book, right?
Oh yeah. I mean, Clay spent 8 years on that book, and honestly, we wish him nothing but success and greatness. It's too much for me to read, and on a personal level, I like the relationship I have from the stories that I grew up with that I know of my dad. And I don't, you know what I mean? To read something else, I don't want that to shift or change. Uh-huh. It has nothing to do with how long the book is. Uh-huh. But the version in my head and heart, or how I know the story, is that's where it's going to stay.
Good.
With the screenplay, it allows for a bit more of an artistic expression of the story. And it's a story that does need to be told, but it's really about these relationships. You know, imagine a friendship that where one person dies, and you know, John Prine was performing a song or dedicating a song to my dad for like 30 years, almost every show.
Yeah.
You know, that type of lasting community and friendship and spirit is something to be celebrated. And I'm really looking forward to getting their story out there.
Good for you. Is there a couple more things and we'll let you run.
Sure.
Is there a website, especially with the Omnivore release? Is the title, It Sure Looked Good on Paper, the Steve Goodman Demos? Is there, how can people find out more about your projects is where I'm getting it.
Okay, so I have the press release in front of me.
Okay.
It just says that it is coming out May 15th. I think you can buy it in any music store. And omnivore.com, I believe. is the record label. They have a lot of reissue releases and catalog projects that they do that are just incredible. They just won a Grammy for a Mr. Rogers Conversations that they released last year. And they just have really good taste.
So
next Friday.
Boy, that's something. May 14th. That's great. Well, good luck on that.
Thank you.
I did not know, and you sent me that little video. It's so sweet. So I just said the pandemic led me to become the temporary nanny for my niece and nephew and school. And I did not know that Steve's grandchild, Ben, just awesome. 8 years old. Talk about Ben and then Louisa, the little Elvis. Talk about working with them.
Yeah, so Ben is quite a character. But since he was talking, he was making up his own songs. And, you know, he would find anything that was like a stick length, like a broom, he would turn it into a guitar. And he just has the music bug. He's got a great voice and he makes up really fun songs. One of his first songs that he wrote was called Black Viper, and he called his band Pfeiffer. So it was Black Viper by Pfeiffer. And, you know, he makes up songs constantly. In fact, he has a Wellness Wednesdays at school, like guidance counselor. And he wrote a suggestion in saying for everybody to sing a song that makes them feel happy. And if you don't know one, make one up. That was his suggestion. And it's just so sweet. And Louisa, who's 7, is a hilarious little clown. And I can say that because she wants to be an actual clown. She does these little routines all the time. But she has a Elvis impersonator costume. And she calls herself Little Elvis. And she's thank you very much. And it's the most adorable thing you could ever see.
And yeah, so connect that with the song Elvis Imitator for the people who don't know Elvis Imitator.
Well, I walk up to the mic and then I shake my hip. Take a deep breath and put a sneer on my lip. See me on the street, you wouldn't know my name. But imitating Elvis is my claim to fame.
Oh, yeah. So we joke with her and we play the song for her. My dad had a song called Elvis Imitators and You Just Can't Stop. And it's a hilarious song. It was one of my favorites when I was a kid, too, just for the humor of it. But it's about this Elvis imitator who he just loves Elvis so much. He even wears the costume, you know, to bed.
Was Mike Smith involved in that song? Was that a co-writer?
He might have been. Yeah.
So that's great. So do they listen to your dad's music, especially the funny stuff, like you mentioned earlier, Talk Backwards and things like
that? You know, they have, and I'll play them the funny stuff, but, you know, the other day Ben asked Alexa to play him Steve Goodman, Banana Republic. So you never know. But they love listening to their grandpa. Actually, the first time we showed Ben songs on like the phone on the video, he watched it for 40 minutes. He watched about 40 minutes of Steve Goodman before I think he could even comprehend that that was his grandfather.
That little video, he was so proud because he first introduced himself as, you know, grandson of Steve Goodman. Then at the end, after he played the guitar stuff, he just looked so proud. You know, it was just, it was really, really cute. So,
They're fantastic kids. And I'm lucky that during the pandemic, I've gotten to spend so much time with them and family in general.
So where we'll wrap it up, we've kind of wrapped it up with everybody is, we did touch on your version of My Old Man, but do you have a couple favorite songs from your father's songbook?
Oh, yeah. I honestly I love his love songs. Yellow Coat is beautiful to me. Would You Like to Learn to Dance? And, what's it called? The one... I always see the video, not Hand It to You, but it's You're the Girl I Love.
Oh, yeah.
It's such a good one. Yeah. So before it was, I loved all of his amusing songs. And then, and now I love all of his love songs.
Good. Well, thank you, Rosanna. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dave.
This was a
so
treat.
Good to talk to you.
Okay, let's stay in touch and good luck with your projects.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, A World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.